The 33 sermons on Nibbana were delivered by the Venerable Bhikkhu Katukurunde Nyanananda in Sinhala at Mitrigala Nisaranavanaya Forest Hermitage. They were translated into English by the same Venerable Monk, presently residing at Potkulkala Forest Hermitage in Kandagedra Devalagam.
Namo tasse bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhasse Namo tasse bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhasse Namo tasse bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhasse Etang santang, etang panitang, yadidang sabba sankhara samatho Sabbupadhipati nissaggo, tannakkhayo, virago, nirodho, nibbana. This is peaceful, this is excellent, namely, the stilling of all preparations, the relinquishment of all assets, the destruction of craving, detachment, cessation, extinction. With the permission of the most venerable great preceptor and the assembly of the venerable meditative monks, this is the 12th sermon in the series of sermons on Nibbana. At the beginning of our last sermon, we brought up the two terms, Papancha and Nippapancha, which help us rediscover quite a deep dimension in Buddhist philosophy, hidden under the sands of time. In our attempt to clarify the meaning of these two terms, initially with the help of the Madhupindika Sutta, what we could determine so far is the fact that Papancha signifies a certain gross stage in sense perception. Though in ordinary linguistic usage, Papancha meant elaboration, circumlocution and verbosity, Madhupindika Sutta has shown us that in the context of sensory perception, it has some special significance. It portrays how a person who directed sense perception is overwhelmed by Papancha Sanya Sankha with regard to sense objects relating to the three periods of time, past, present and future, as a result of his indulging in Papancha based on reasoning about percepts. All this goes to show that Papancha has connotations of some kind of delusion, obsession and confusion arising in a man's mind due to sense perception. In explaining the meaning of this term, commentators very often make use of words like pamatta, excessively intoxicated, indolent, pamada, heedlessness, and madana, intoxication. For example, kenatthena papancho, matta pamatta akara papanatthena. Papancha in what sense? In the sense that it leads one on to a state of intoxication and indolence. Sometimes it is commented on as follows. Panchita cha kunti pamatta akara patta. They are subject to pamancha, that is, they become more or less inebriated or indolent. Or else it is explained as madanakara santhito kilesa papancho. Papancha of a defiling nature which is of an inebriating character. On the face of it, papancha looks like a term similar in sense to pamada, indolence, heedlessness. But there is a subtle difference in meaning between them. Pamada, even etymologically, conveys the basic idea of excessive intoxication. It has a nuance of inactivity or inefficiency due to intoxication. The outcome of such a state of affairs is either negligence or heedlessness. But as we have already pointed out, papancha has an etymological background suggestive of expansion, elaboration, verbosity and circumlocution. Therefore, it has no connotations of inactivity and inefficiency. On the other hand, it seems to imply an inability to reach the goal due to a deviation from the correct path. Let us try to understand the distinction in meaning between pamada and papancha with the help of an illustration. Suppose we ask someone to go on an urgent errand to Colombo. If instead of going to Colombo, he goes to the nearest tavern and gets drunk and sleeps there, That is the case of Pamada. If, on the other hand, he takes to a long labyrinthine road, avoiding the shortest cut to Colombo, and finally reaches Kandy instead of Colombo, that is Papancha. There is such a subtle difference in the nuances associated with these two terms. Incidentally, there is a couplet among the sixes of the Anguttara Nikaya which sounds like a distant echo of the illustration we have already given. Yo papancham anuyuttu papanchabhirato mago viradhai so nibbanam yogakhemam anuttaram yo cha papancham hitvane nippapancha pade rato aradhai so nibbanam yogakhemam anuttaram. The fool who indulges in papancha, being excessively fond of it, has missed the way to Nibbana, the incomparable freedom from bondage. He who, having given up Papancha, delights in the path to Nippapancha, is well on the way to Nibbana, the incomparable freedom from bondage. This way we can understand the difference between the two words, Papancha and Pamada, in respect of the nuances associated with them. Commentaries very often explain the term Papancha simply as a synonym of craving, conceit, and vips. Tanha ditti mananam etam adhivachanam. But it does not amount to a definition of papancha as such. It is true that there are instances of papancha, for even in the Madhupindika Sutta, we came across the three expressions abhinanditabbam, abhivaditabbam, and ajhosetabbam suggestive of them. Abhinanditabbam means what is worth delighting in. Abhivaditabbam means what is worth asserting. Ajhosetabbam means what is worth clinging on to. These three expressions are very often used in the discourses to denote the three defilements, craving, conceit, and vips. That is to say, delighting in by way of craving with the thought, this is mine. Asserting by way of conceit with the thought, this am I. And clinging on to the dogmatic view, this is my soul. Therefore, the commentarial exegesis on Papancha in terms of craving, conceit, and vips is to a great extent justifiable. However, what is particularly significant about the term Papancha is that it conveys the sense of proliferation and complexity of thought on the lines of those three basic tendencies. That is why the person concerned is said to be overwhelmed by Papancha Sanya Sankha. Here we need to clarify for ourselves the meaning of the word Sankha. According to the commentary, it means parts. Papancha sanya sankhati ette kottasa. Papancha sanya sankha, herein sankha means parts. In that case, papancha sankha could be rendered as parts of papancha, which says nothing significant about sankha itself. On the other hand, if one carefully examines the contexts in which the terms papancha sanya sankha and papancha sankha are used in the discourses, one gets the impression that sankha means something deeper than part or portion. Sankha, samanya, and panyati are more or less synonymous terms. Out of them, panyati is fairly well known as a term for designation. Sankha and samanya are associated in sense with panyati. Sankha means reckoning and samanya is appellation. These three terms are often used in connection with worldly usage. We come across quite a significant reference relevant to this question of Papancha in the Niruttipatha Sutta of the Khanda Sanyutta in Sanyutta Nikaya. It runs, Tayomi bhikkhave niruttipatha, adhivachana patha, panyati patha, asankinna, asankinna pubba, nasankiyanti, nasankiyissanti, appatikuttha samanehi brahmanehi vinyuhi, katametayo, tam bhikkhave rupang, atitang niruddhang viparinatang, ahositita sankha, ahositi tassa samanya, ahositi tassa panyati, na tassa sankha atiti, na tassa sankha bhavissatiti. Once there are these three paths of linguistic usage, of synonyms and of designation, that are not mixed up, have never been mixed up, that are not doubted and will not be doubted, and are undespised by intelligent recluses and Brahmins. What are the three? Whatever form monks that is past, ceased, transformed, it was is the reckoning for it. It was is its appellation. It was is its designation. It is not reckoned as it is. It is not reckoned as it will be. The burden of this discourse, as it proceeds in this way, is the maxim that the three periods of time should never be mixed up or confounded. For instance, with regard to that form that is past, a verb in the past tense is used. One must not imagine what is past to be existing as something present. Nor should one imagine whatever belongs to the future as already existing in the present. Whatever has been is past. Whatever is present. It is a common mistake to conceive of something that is yet to come as something already present, and to imagine whatever is past also as present. This is the confusion the world is seeing. That is why those recluses and Brahmins who are wise do not mix them up. Just as the above quoted para speaks of whatever is past, so the discourse continues to make similar statements with regard to whatever is present or future. It touches upon all the five aggregates. For instance, whatever form that is present is reckoned as it is and not as it was or it will be. Similarly, whatever form that is yet to come is reckoned as it will be and not as it was or it is. This is how the Niruttipatha Sutta lays down the basic principle of not confounding the linguistic usages pertaining to the three periods of time. Throughout this discourse, the term sankhara is used in the sense of reckoning. In fact, three terms, sankhara, samanya and panyati, are used somewhat synonymously in the same way as nirutti, adhivachana and panyati. All these are in sense akin to each other insofar as they represent the problem of world usage. This makes it clear that the intriguing term papancha sanya sankha has a relevance to the question of language and modes of linguistic usage. The term could thus be rendered as reckonings born of prolific perception. If we are to go deeper into the significance of the term sankha, we may say that its basic sense in linguistic usage is connected with numerals, since it means reckoning. As a matter of fact, numerals are more primitive than letters in a language. To perceive is to grasp a sign of permanence in something. Perception has the characteristic of grasping a sign. It is with the help of signs that one recognizes. Perceptions of forms, perceptions of sounds, perceptions of smells, perceptions of tastes, etc. are so many ways of grasping signs. Just as a party going through a forest would blaze a trail with an axe in order to find their way back with the help of notches on the trees, so does perception catch a sign in order to be able to recognize. This perception is like the groping of a blind man or fumbling in the dark. There is a tendency of the mind to grasp a sign after whatever is felt. So it gives rise to perceptions of form, perceptions of sounds, etc. The sign necessarily involves the notion of permanence. That is to say, a sign stands for permanence. A sign has to remain unchanged until one returns to it to recognize it. That is also the secret behind the mirage nature of perception as a whole. As a matter of fact, the word sanya, used to denote perception as such, primarily means sign, symbol, or mark with which one recognizes. But recognition alone is not enough. What is recognized has to be made known to the world, to the society at large. That is why sanya or perception is followed by sankha or reckoning. The relationship between sankha, samanya and panyati in this connection could also be explained. Sankha as reckoning or counting totals up or adds up into groups of say 5 or 6. It facilitates our work, particularly in common or communal activities. So the most primitive symbol in a language is the numeral. Samanya or appellation is a common agreement as to how something should be known. If everyone has his own way of making known, exchange of ideas would be impossible. Panyati or designation determines the pattern of whatever is commonly agreed upon. This way we can understand the affinity of meaning between the terms sankha, samanya and panyati. Among them, Sankha is the most primitive form of reckoning. It does not simply mean reckoning or adding up in terms of numerals. It is characteristic of language too, as we may infer from the occurrence of the expression Sankham Gacchati in many discourses. There, the reckoning meant is a particular linguistic usage. We come across a good illustration of such a linguistic usage in Mahathipadopama Sutta, where Venerable Sariputta is addressing his fellow monks. Sayathapi auso kattancha paticcha vallincha paticcha tinancha paticcha mattikancha paticcha akaso parivarito agaranteva sankham gacchati evameva kho auso atkincha paticcha naharuncha paticcha mangsancha paticcha chammancha paticcha akaso parivarito rupanteva sankham gacchati. Friends, just as when space is enclosed by timber and creepers, grass and clay, it comes to be reckoned as a house, even so, when a space is enclosed by bones and sinews, flesh and skin, it comes to be reckoned as a material form. Here the expression Sankham Gacchati stands for a designation as a concept. It is the way something comes to be known. Let us go for another illustration from a sermon from the Buddha himself. It is one that throws a flood of light on some deep aspects of Buddhist philosophy relating to language, grammar and logic. It comes in the Pottapada Sutta of the Digha Nikaya, where the Buddha is exhorting Chitta Hattisariputta. Sayathapi Chitta Gava Kheeram Kheeramha Dadhi Dadhimha Navanitam Navanitamha Sappi Sappimha Sappimando Yasming Same Kheeram Hoti Neva Tasming Same Dadhiti Sankham Gacchati Na Navanitanti Sankham Gacchati Na Sappiti Sankham Gacchati Na Sappimandoti Sankham Gacchati Kheeram Teva Tasming Same Sankham Gacchati. Just chitta, as from a cow comes milk, and from milk curds, and from curds butter, and from butter ghee, and from ghee junket. But when it is milk, it is not reckoned as curd or butter or ghee or junket. It is then simply reckoned as milk. We shall break up the relevant quotation into three parts for facility of comment. This is the first part giving the introductory simile. The simile itself looks simple enough, though it is suggestive of something deep. The simile is in fact extended to each of the other stages of milk formations, namely curd, butter, ghee and junket, pointing out that in each case it is not reckoned otherwise. Now comes the corresponding doctrinal point. Evameva kho chitta yasming samaye olariko attapatilabho hoti Neva tasming samaye manomayo attapatilabhoti sankham gacchati Na arupo attapatilabhoti sankham gacchati Olariko attapatilabhotveva tasming samaye sankham gacchati. Just so chitta, when the gross mode of personality is going on, it is not reckoned as the mental mode of personality, nor as the formless mode of personality. It is then simply reckoned as the gross mode of personality. These three modes of personality correspond to the three planes of existence, the sensuous, the form, and the formless. The first refers to the ordinary physical frame sustained by material food, kavalinkara harbhakko, enjoying the sense pleasures. At the time a person is in this sensuous sphere, possessing the gross mode of personality, one must not imagine that the mental mode or the formless mode of personality is hidden in him. This is the type of confusion the ascetics entrenched in the Saul theory fell into. They even conceived of self as fivefold, encased in concentric shells. Whereas in the Taittiriya Upanishad, one comes across the Panchakosha theory. The reference here is to three states of the self as gross, mental and formless modes of personality. Out of the five selves known to Upanishadic philosophy, namely Annamaya, Pranamaya, Sanyamaya, Vijnanamaya and Anandamaya, only three find mention here in some form or other. The gross mode of personality corresponds to Annamayatman. The mental mode of personality is equivalent to Sanyamayatman, while the formless mode of personality stands for Vijnanamayatman. The correct perspective of understanding this distinction is provided by the milk simile. Suppose someone gets a jhana and attains to a mental mode of personality. He should not imagine that the formless mode of personality is already latent in him. Nor should he think that the former gross mode of personality is still lingering in him. They are just temporary states to be distinguished like milk and curd. This is the moral the Buddha is trying to drive home. Now we come to the third part of the quotation, giving the Buddha's conclusion, which is extremely important. Ima khochitta loka samanya, loka niruttyo, loka vohara, loka panyatyo, yahi tathagato voharati aparamasam. For all these chitta are worldly appellations, worldly expressions, worldly usages, worldly designations, which the Tathagata makes use of without tenacious grasping. It is the last word in the quotation, aparamasam, which is extremely important. There is no tenacious grasping. The Buddha uses the language much in the same way as parents make use of a child's homely petal for purposes of mediation. He had to present this Dhamma, which goes against the current, through the medium of worldly language, with which the worldlings have their transaction in defilements. That is probably the reason why the Buddha at first hesitated to preach this Dhamma. He must have wondered how he can convey such a deep Dhamma through the terminology, the grammar and the logic of worldlings. All this shows the immense importance of the Pottapada Sutta. If the ordinary worldling presumes that ghee is already inherent in the milk obtained from the cow, he will try to argue it out on the grounds that after all it is milk that becomes ghee. And once it becomes ghee, he might imagine that milk is still to be found in ghee in some latent form. As a general statement, this might sound ridiculous, but even great philosophers were unaware of the implications of their theories. That is why the Buddha had to come out with this homely milk simile to bring them to their senses. Here lies the secret of the soul theory. It carried with it the implication that past and future also exist in the same sense as the present. The Buddha, on the other hand, uses the verb atthi is only for what exists in the present. He points out that whatever is past should be referred to as ahosi, was, and whatever is yet to come in the future should be spoken of as bhavishyati, will be. This is the fundamental principle underlying the Niruttipatti Sutta already quoted. Any departure from it would give rise to such confusions as referred to above. Milk, curd, butter and ghee are merely so many stages in a certain process. The worldlings, however, have put them into watertight compartments by designating and circumscribing them. They are caught up in the conceptual trap of their own making. When the philosophers started working out the logical relationship between cause and effect, they tended to regard these two as totally unrelated to each other. Since milk becomes curd, either the two are totally different from each other, or curd must already be latent in milk for it to become curd. This is the kind of dilemma their logic posed for them. Indian philosophical systems reflect a tendency towards such logical subtleties. They ended up with various extreme views concerning the relation between cause and effect. In a certain school of Indian philosophy known as Arambhavada, effect is explained as something totally new, unrelated to the cause. Other schools of philosophy such as Satkaryavada and Satkaranavada also arose by confusing this issue. For them, effect is already found hidden in the cause before it comes out. Yet others took only the cause as real. Such extreme conclusions were the result of forgetting the fact that all these are mere concepts in worldly usage. Here we have a case of getting caught up in a conceptual trap of one's own making. This confusion regarding the three periods of time, characteristic of such philosophers, could be illustrated with some folk tales and fables which lucidly bring out a deep truth. There is, for instance, the tale of the goose that lays the golden eggs, well known to the West. A certain goose used to lay a golden egg every day. Its owner, out of excessive greed, thought of getting all the eggs at once. He killed the goose and opened it up only to come to grief. He had wrongly imagined the future to be already existing in the present. This is the kind of blunder the soul theorists also committed. In the field of philosophy too, the prolific tendency led to such subtle complications. It is not much different from the proliferations indulged in by the ordinary worldling in his daily life. That is why reckonings born of prolific perception are said to be so overwhelming. One is overwhelmed by one's own reckonings and figurings out under the influence of prolific perception. An Indian poet once spotted a ruby shining in the moonlight and eagerly approached it, enchanted by it, only to find a blood-red spittle of beetle. We often come across such humorous stories in literature, showing the pitfalls of prolific conceptualization. The introductory story leading up to the Dhammapada verse on the rambling nature of the mind, Durangamang Ekacharang Asarirang Guhasayang, etc., verse 5, Chittavagga, as recorded in the commentary to the Dhammapada, is very illustrative. The pupil of Venerable Sankarakita Thera, a navy office, indulged in a papancha while fanning his teacher. In his imagination, he disrobed, got married, had a child, and was coming in a chariot with his wife and child to see his former teacher. The wife, through carelessness, dropped the child, and the chariot ran over it. So he whipped his wife in a fit of anger, only to realize that he had dealt a blow on his teacher's head with the fan still in his hand. Being an arahant with psychic powers, his teacher immediately understood the pupil's state of the mind, much to the latter's discomfiture. A potter in Sanskrit literature smashed his pots in a sort of business papancha and was remorseful afterwards. Similarly, the proud milkmaid in English literature dropped the bucket of milk on her head in a daydream of a rosy future. In all these cases, one takes as present something that is to come in the future. This is a serious confusion between the three periods of time. The perception of permanence, characteristic of concepts, lures one away from reality into a world of fantasy. With the result, one is overwhelmed and obsessed by it. So this is what is meant by papancha sanya sankha samudacharana. So overwhelming are reckonings born of prolific perception. As we saw above, the word sankha is therefore nearer to the idea of reckoning than that of part or portion. Tathagatas are free from such reckonings born of prolific perception, papancha sanya sankha, because they make use of worldly linguistic usages, conventions, and designations, being fully aware of their worldly origin, as if they are using a child's language. When an adult uses a child's language, he is not bound by it. Likewise, the Buddhas and Arahants do not forget that these are worldly usages. They do not draw any distinction between the relative and the absolute with regard to those concepts. For them, they are merely concepts and designations in worldly usage. That is why the Tathagatas are said to be free from papancha. That is to say, they are nipapancha, whereas the world delights in papancha. This fact is clearly expressed in the following verse in the Dhammapada. Akase padang natthi samano natthi bahire papancha bhirata paja nipapancha tathagata. No track is there in the air and no recluse elsewhere. This populace delights in prolificity, but thus born ones are non-prolific. It is because the Tathagatas are non-prolific that Nipapancha is regarded as one of the epithets of Nibbana in a long list of 33. Like Dukkhupasama, quelling of suffering, Papancha Bhupasama, quelling of prolificity, is also recognized as an epithet of Nibbana. It is also referred to as Papancha Nirodha, cessation of prolificity. We come across such references to Nibbana in terms of Papancha quite often. The Tathagatas are free from papancha sanya sankha, although they make use of worldly concepts and designations. In the Kalaha Vivada Sutta, we come across the dictum sanya nidana hi papancha sankha, according to which reckonings through prolificity arise from perception. Now the Tathagatas have gone beyond the pale of perception in attaining wisdom. That is why they are free from papancha sanya sankha. reckonings born of prolific perception. Such reckonings are the lot of those who grow up in the murk of ignorance under the influence of perception. Since Buddhas and Arahants are enlightened with wisdom and released from the limitations of perception, they do not entertain such reckonings born of prolific perception. Hence we find the following statement in the Udana. Tena kuhupana samayena bhagava attano papancha sanya sankha pahanam pachyavikhamano nisinno hoti. And at that time the exalted one was seated contemplating his own abandonment of reckonings born of prolific perception. The allusion here is to the bliss of emancipation. Quite a meaningful verse also occurs in this particular context. Yassa papancha thitica natthi sandanam paligantya vitivatto tang tang nittannam munin charantam navajanati sadeva kopi loko. To whom there are no proliferations and standstills, who have gone beyond the bond and the deadlock, in that craving-free sage, as he fares along, the world with its gods sees nothing to decry. The two words papancha and thiti in juxtaposition highlight the primary sense of papancha as a rambling or straying away. According to the Nettipakarana, the idiomatic standstill mentioned here refers to the latencies, anusaya. So the rambling papanchas and doggedly persisting anusayas are no longer there. The two words sandhanam and paligham are also metaphorically used in the Dhamma. Weaves, ditti, are the bond, and ignorance, avijja, is the deadlock. The fact that papancha is characteristic of worldly thoughts connected with the household life emerges from the following verse in Salayatana Sanyutta of Sanyutta Nikaya. Papancha sanya itaritaranara papancha yanta upayanti sanyino manomayam gehasitancha sabbam panujya nikhammasitam iriyat. The common run of humanity impelled by prolific perception approach their objects with rambling thoughts, limited by perception as they are. Dispelling all what is mind-made and connected with the household, one moves towards that which is connected with renunciation. The approach meant here is comparable to the approach of that imaginative poet towards the ruby shining in moonlight, only to discover a spittle of beetle. The last two lines of the verse bring out the correct approach of one who is aiming at Nibbana. It requires the dispelling of such daydreams connected with the household as entertained by the Nevivo Venerable Sangharakita Thera. Worldlings are in the habit of constructing speculative views by taking too seriously linguistic usage and grammatical structure. All pre-Buddhistic philosophers made such blunders as the confusion between milk and curd. Their blunders were mainly due to two reasons, namely the persistent latency towards perception and the dogmatic adherence to views. It is precisely these two points that came up in the very first statement of the Madhupindika Sutta discussed in our previous sermon. That is to say, it formed the gist of the Buddha's cursory reply to Sakya Dandapani's question. For the latter, it was a riddle, and that is why he raised his eyebrows, wagged his tongue and shook his head. The question was, what does the recluse assert and what does he proclaim? The Buddha's reply was, according to whatever doctrine, one does not quarrel or dispute with anyone. In the world, such a doctrine do I preach. And due to whatever statements perceptions do not underlie as latencies, such statements do I proclaim. This might well appear a strange paradox, but since we have already made some clarification of the two terms, sanya and panya, we might as well bring up now an excellent quotation to distinguish the difference between these two. It is in fact the last verse in the Magandhya Sutta of the Sutta Nipata, the grand finale as it were. Sanya virattasya nasanti gantha, panya vimuttasya nasanti moha, sanyancha dittincha ye aggahesum, te ghatyanta vicharanti loke. To one unattached to percepts, no bonds exist. In one released through wisdom, no delusions persist, but they that cling to percepts and vives go about wrangling in this world. In the Puppa Sutta of the Khanda Samyukta, one comes across the following declaration of the Buddha. Nahang bhikkave lokena vivadami, lokocha maya vivadati. Monks, I do not dispute with the world. It is the world that is disputing with me. This looks more or less a contradictory statement, as if one would say, he is quarrelling with me, but I am not quarrelling with him. However, the truth of this statement lies in the fact that the Buddha did not hold on to any view. Some might think that the Buddha also held on to some view or other. But he was simply using the child's language. For him, there was nothing worth holding on to in it. There is a canonical episode which is a good illustration of this fact. One of the most well-known among the debates the Buddha had with the ascetics of other sects is the debate with Satchaka, the naked ascetic. An account of it is found in the Chula Satchaka Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya. The debate had all the outward appearance of a hot dispute. However, towards the end of it, the Buddha makes the following challenge to Satchaka. As for you, Aggivesana, drops of sweat have come down from your forehead, soaked through your upper robe, and reached the ground. But, Aggivesana, there is no sweat on my body now. So saying, he uncovered his golden hued body in that assembly. Iti bhagava tasmin parisatin suvannavannam kayam vivari. Even in the midst of a hot debate, the Buddha had no agitation because he did not adhere to any views. There was for him no bondage in terms of craving, conceit and views. Even in the thick of a heated debate, the Buddha was uniformly calm and cool. It is the same with regard to perception. Percepts do not persist as a latency in him. We spoke of name and form as an image or reflection. Buddhas do not have the delusion arising out of name and form, since they have comprehended it as a self-image. There is a verse in the Sabhya Sutta of the Sutta Nipata which puts across this idea. Anuvicca papancha nama rupam ajhattam bahiddhacha rogamulam sabba rogamula bandhana pamutto anuvidito tadi pauchate tathatta. Having understood name and form, which is a product of prolificity, and which is the root of all malady within and without, he is released from bondage to the root of all maladies. That such like one is truly known as the one who has understood. Name and form is a product of papancha, the worldling's prolificity. He spoke of the reflection of a gem in a pond and the image of a dog on a plank across the stream. One's grasp on one's world of name and form is something similar. Now, as for the Buddha, he has truly comprehended the nature of name and form. Whatever maladies, complications and malignant conditions there are within beings and around them, the root cause of all that malady is this papanchanam rupa. To be free from it is to be such. He is the one who has really understood. If we are to say something in particular about the latency of perception, we have to pay special attention to the first discourse in the Majjhima Nikaya. The advice usually given to one who picks up the Majjhima Nikaya these days is to skip the very first sutta. Why? Because it is not easy to understand it. Even the monks to whom it was preached could not understand it and were displeased. It is too deep for us. Leave it alone. But it must be pointed out that such an advice is not much different from asking one to learn a language without studying the alphabet. This is because the first discourse of the Majjhima Nikaya, namely Mula Pariyaya Sutta, enshrines an extremely vital first principle in the entire field of Buddhist philosophy. Just as much as the first discourse of the Digha Nikaya, namely Brahmajala Sutta, is of great relevance to the question of views, even so, the Mula Pariyaya Sutta is extremely important for its relevance to the question of perception. Now, what is the basic theme of this discourse? There is a certain pattern in the way objects occur to the mind and are apperceived. This discourse lays bare that elementary pattern. The Buddha opens this discourse with the declaration, Sabba Dhamma Mula Pariyayang Bo Bhikkave Desisami. Monks, I shall preach to you the basic pattern of behavior of all mind objects. In a nutshell, the discourse deals with 24 concepts representative of concepts in the world. These are fitted into a schema to illustrate the attitude of four types of persons towards them. The 24 concepts mentioned in the sutta are Pathavi, Apo, Tejo, Vayo, Bhuta, Deva, Pajapati, Brahma, Abhasara, Subhakinna, Vihaphala, Abhibhu, Akasananchayatana, Vinyananchayatana, Akinchanyayatana, Nevasanyana Sanyayatana, Dittang, Sutang, Mutang, Vinyatang, Ekatang, Nanatang, Sabbang, Nibbana. Earth, water, fire, air, beings, gods, Pajapati, Brahma, the Abhasara Brahma, the Subhakinna Brahmas, the Vehaphala Brahmas, the Overlord, the realm of infinite space, the realm of infinite consciousness, the realm of nothingness, the realm of neither perception nor non-perception, the seen, the heard, the sensed, the cognized, unity, diversity, all Nibbana. The discourse describes the differences of attitude in four types of persons with regard to each of these concepts. The four persons are: one, an untaught, ordinary person who has no regard for noble ones and is unskilled in their dhamma, asutava puthujjano. Two, a monk who is in higher training, whose mind has not yet reached the goal and is aspiring to the supreme security from bondage, bhikkhus ekho appattamanasu. An arahant with taints destroyed, who has lived the holy life, done what has to be done, laid down the burden, freed the goal, destroyed the fetters of existence, and is completely liberated through final knowledge, arahant khinasavo. For the Tathagata, accomplished and fully enlightened, Tathagato arahant samma sambuddho. Out of these, the second category comprises the stream winner, the once returner, and the non-returner. Though there are four types, according to the analysis of their attitudes, the last two can be regarded as one type, since their attitudes to those concepts are the same. So we might as well speak of three kinds of attitude. Let us now try to understand the difference between them. What is the worldview of the untaught ordinary person, the worldview? The Buddha describes it as follows. Pataving patavito sanjanat, pataving patavito sanyatva, pataving manyati, pataviya manyati, patavito manyati, pataving meti manyati, pataving abhinandati, tankisahetu, aparinyatang tasati vadani. He perceives earth as earth. Having perceived earth as earth, he imagines earth as such. He imagines on the earth. He imagines from the earth. He imagines earth is mine. He delights in earth. Why is that? I say that it is because he has not fully comprehended it. The untaught ordinary person can do no better than to perceive earth as earth, since he is simply groping in the dark. So he perceives earth as earth and goes on imagining, for which the word used here is manyati, methinks. One usually methinks when a simile or metaphor occurs as a figure of speech. But here it is something more than that. Here it refers to an indulgence in a deluded mode of thinking under the influence of craving, conceit and views. Perceiving earth as earth, he imagines earth to be substantially earth. Then he resorts to inflection to make it flexible or amenable to his mythinking. On the earth, from the earth is mine, are so many subtle ways of mythinking, with which he finally finds delight in the very concept of earth. The reason for all this is the fact that he has not fully comprehended it. Then comes the worldview of the monk who is in higher training, that is, the seeker. Pathavim patavito abhijanati, pathavim patavito abhinyaya, pathavim mamanyi, pataviya mamanyi, pathavito mamanyi, pathaving meti mamanyi, pathaving mabhinandi, tankisehetu parinyayam tasati vadan. He understands through higher knowledge earth as earth. Having known through higher knowledge earth as earth, let him not imagine on the earth, let him not imagine from the earth, let him not imagine earth is mine, let him not delight in earth. Why is that? I say it is because it should be well comprehended by him. As for the monk who is in higher training, he does not merely perceive, but understands through higher knowledge. Here we are against a peculiar expression which is rather problematic, that is, mamanyi. The commentary simply glosses over with the words manyatiti manyi, taking it to mean the same as manyati, imagine. Its only explanation for the use of this peculiar expression in this context is that the seeker, or the one in higher training, has already done away with dittimanyana, or imagining in terms of this, though he still has imaginings through craving and conceit. So for the commentary, mamanyi is a sort of mild recognition of residual imagining, a dilly-dally phrase. But this interpretation is not at all convincing. Obviously enough, the particle ma has a prohibitive sense here, and mamanyi means let one not imagine, or let one not entertain imaginings, manyana. A clear instance of the use of this expression in this sense is found at the end of the Samiddhi Sutta discussed in an earlier sermon. Venerable Samiddhi answered Venerable Sariputta's catechism creditably, and the latter acknowledged it with a well done, sadhu sadhu, but cautioned him not to be proud of it, tenacha mamanyi, but do not be vain on account of it. The use of the prohibitive particle with reference to the worldview of the monk in higher training is quite apt, as he has to train himself in overcoming the tendency to go on imagining. For him, it is a step of training towards full comprehension. That is why the Buddha concludes with the words, "Why is that? I say it is because it should be well comprehended by him."
Dear listeners, it is our sincere wish to make these sermons accessible free of charge to all who like to listen to them, because the gift of the Dhamma excels all other gifts. We therefore encourage you to copy these sermons and share them with others, but kindly note that they should not be reproduced for sale. May the blessings of the Triple Gem be with you.